Interest rates down to a record low of 2%. What should you do if you're nearing retirement? How can you make sure the nest egg meets your needs, particularly if you live 20, 30 years beyond the gold watch? With life expectancy into the 80s for both men and women, how much do you need? Should you buy shares, bonds, property, a mixture of all three? Financial advisor Roger Montgomery from the Montgomery Fund is with us tonight to give us some insights into what is a very curious state of play. Roger, I have never seen interest rates this low.
Well, they've never been this low. So this is a record. What we've got is a situation that's reflecting in interest rates, reflecting a terrible economic scenario. Mm. And I think the Reserve Bank statement today tried to paint as rosy a picture as was possible. But if things were going well, we wouldn't see interest rates being cut. This means, obviously, it's good for borrowers. But despite Joe Halke's advice today that now is the time to borrow to invest and now's the time to borrow for property and so forth, I disagree with that absolutely entirely. I think it's the wrong time of the cycle to be buying assets that are already very expensive. There's a very basic rule in investing. The higher the price you pay, the lower your return.
You have to say that the markets didn't know how to take it either, because one would imagine that if you cut the interest rate, the Australian dollar would fall. It went up.
Well, it fell initially and then it bounced. That's exactly right. And it sits at about 79 cents again.
And you would think that the stock market would be rallying as a result of the interest rate cut. It fell. Well, so, it's just immediately after.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, Tony.
Yeah.
The reason why the stock market fell is there's some nervousness creeping in, and the canary in the coal mine might actually be Australian 10-year bond rates.
Yep.
So this is the rate that we use in funds management to value companies and value all assets. And interest rates, just by way of background, interest rates work a little bit like gravity on Earth. If interest rates are stronger, higher, in other words, then that drags the value of assets down. If interest rates are weaker and lower, then asset prices go up. So what we've seen around the world through this quantitative easing program and interest of the ZERP policy in the United States, which stands for zero interest rate policy,
yep.
What we've seen is we've seen asset prices go up. Once interest rates are at zero, monetary policy is ineffective. That means, you know, if you're not getting growth in the economy when you cut interest rates to nothing,
you can't cut zero.
You can't cut it any more than that. And so quantitative easing was designed to actually spur the economy on. But what in effect has been found out is it's done very little to get people consuming and investing and spending money. When I mean investing, I mean business investment. What it's actually done is it spurred asset speculation. So property prices have gone up, and we've seen that in Australia as well. Mm. Stock prices are now at you know, all-time highs in some markets. And we'll talk about all the particular factors that might signal things are expensive and a bit overheated.
I was just going to say the Reserve Bank Governor Glenn Stevens only last week said, look, retirees are going to have a pretty tough road over the next couple of years. Are you finding any sort of value at all?
Well, there's no doubt about that. And what's actually – the belief is that if you push prices for property up – and this is why Joe Halke partly says what he says. If prices for property are elevated, if prices for stocks are elevated, then people theoretically will feel more confident. They'll go out and spend money. And if they spend money, then businesses will be inclined to invest in themselves and employ people. That's good for the economy. Then interest rates can go back up again and everyone will be happy. Here's the problem. If interest rates go up again, then what that means is the value of those assets drops. Not necessarily the price straight away, but the value definitely drops. And if the value drops, then the thing upon which consumption and confidence was built disappears again. Yeah. And so this is the dilemma. We may end up in a situation where it's really dire for retirees because interest rates stay very low for a very long time.
It's really difficult to invest in risky assets if you have a smaller horizon. It's one of those things if you're in your 30s and 40s, there's plenty of time to recover. But yes. If you're in your 70s and 80s, any major downfall could be quite difficult.
Well, it's going to be difficult to recover from that. The mistake that I think many investors make, Tony, and this is really, really important. I was at an Australian Shareholders Association conference yesterday in Melbourne, and I was a guest speaker there. And the question everyone had on their lips was, I need income to eat. I need income. But the mistake that people make is that they look at dividend yields to determine where their best source of income is. And that could lead you astray, because the best source of income is a business that's growing its cash flows and has the ability to throw off excess cash in time. So I'll give you an example very quickly. In 2005, you could have put $100 into Telstra shares, and in 2015, 10 years later, that $100 is probably worth a little bit over $100, maybe $105. And 10 years ago, if you'd put $100 into Telstra, you would have earned about $5.70 in income, and today you're earning about $5.70 in income. Now, in an inflationary environment, in an environment where things go up in price, well, that $5.70 today is worth less than the $5.70 10 years ago. So that's not good enough. You need to be buying income that grows. So I'll give you another example. In 2005, if you'd bought another technology company, this company's called M2 Telecommunications, you put $100 into that company, it didn't even pay a dividend 10 years ago. I think the year after it paid about, I think it was 20 cents or something like that. It was nothing. But your income was zero 10 years ago. Now that $100, not only is that $100 now worth about $1,600, but where you were earning no income 10 years ago, you're now earning a 25% yield on your purchase price. So it's better to buy quality businesses that are going to grow and can grow their cash flows. But the mistake investors make is they look at the yield and they compare it to what they're getting in a bank account, and they think they're the same thing, and they're not, because shares are risky.
It's interesting because we are having bank reporting season at the moment. We had ANZ out today, Westpac yesterday, and they've been seen as almost a de facto investment simply because of the interest stream from them and the dividend stream.
Well, yes, ANZ's result was good and Westpac not so good.
Yeah. It's just an awkward situation too, because it appears that the government is going to change their ground rules for operating here, requiring them to hold more capital.
Well, we talked about that the last time I was on the program.
And become, so therefore, less productive.
Well, that's exactly right. So they're going to have more capital, which means that their profitability will be reduced. They're going to be penalised because the playing field is not level with the regional banks. So the regional banks are going to be able to compete better. And the other thing that's going to change is what's called the mortgage risk weighting ratio. So the amount of money they can keep in order to lend money for mortgages. Now, ANZ's growth, half of its credit growth is mortgages, and had 9% growth in mortgages. So most of it, the 9% odd growth that it had in gross profit, came from mortgages and lending in Asia and New Zealand. That's where the bulk of its growth came from. Westpac's results weren't as good. But what this means, Tony, in an environment that I described earlier, where interest rates might start going up and people start borrowing less when they realise, this has only happened over the last 4 days. So we're talking about something that's really red raw. It's happening right now. And that could mean that the banks are what we call in our industry over-earning. It's as good as it's going to get. All the tailwinds are there. All the ducks are lined up. It doesn't get better than this, and the share price might not go any higher.
Also, just the flow-on effects, if they change the ratios that was required. The ANZ chief, Mike Smith, said today that they may have to sell their stakes in banks in Indonesia, Malaysia and China to satisfy the Australian regulators. That doesn't sound like a positive to me.
And Asanda Finance is on the block and going to be sold as well. And so what you're going to find is that the banks are going to need to raise capital. They're going to have to increase their capital because they can't grow it organically. So they can't get it from reinvesting profits as quickly as they would like.
Just a couple of little SMS responses. ING apparently has already passed on the 0.25% drop. David from Graceville was passing that on. Ray says, I'm 54, not really planning on retiring soon, but all my super is in growth plans, you know, high risk. At what point to retirement should I lower that risk, Ray?
Okay, so here's the thing. It doesn't matter what age you are, believe it or not. And I know conventional wisdom and conventional advice says that a young person can have more risk and more growth, and an older person less risk, less growth, and more income. I don't think you can. It's a bit like a square peg in a round hole. You can't make the stock market fit those requirements. The stock market is a place where you simply do the same thing irrespective of your age, and that is, you buy outstanding businesses at reasonable prices. Now, the market inevitably swings from extreme bouts of enthusiasm, which it's enjoying right now, and I'm going to go through some examples of some really, really crazy stuff that's going on.
Yep.
And then it swings to extreme bouts of pessimism. In between are long periods where nothing really happens and volatility stays low. That's the time that you want to invest is after a period of severe pessimism, and you'll get a long period where things start to recover. We're not in that situation now. So the suggestion.
So if you look at the 2008 situation where there was the worldwide collapse.
Yes.
It took about 12 months for the Australian market to recover most of the loss.
Well, it took a lot longer than that, Tony. It's only just starting to recover now, believe it or not. You know, the stock market hasn't reached its previous highs. So it's going to take some time. And the reason why that is because the stock market, inverted commas, is made up of average and mediocre large businesses. It's not made up of outstanding businesses. My view of blue chip companies, they come in all different shapes and sizes, and then some small companies that are blue chips. The All Ordinaries Index, the ASX 200, the ASX 300 are dominated by large businesses that are relatively mediocre. And so Telstra, for example, for all of its gains in the last, what is it, last 5 years, I think since October, I think on October 2010 it was $2.57. It's now recently been at $6.50. If you take it, so people say, wow, that's fantastic. It's, you know, it's almost tripled. But the reality is that its profit and its dividends are largely unchanged over 10 years. And the price is back to where it was more than 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So there's been no net change. Now, the index, the stock market, is invested in those businesses. They dominate the index. And so my concern is that people use the index as their proxy for when to invest instead of looking at individual businesses. So the key is to look at individual businesses. Right now, though, things look very, very frothy. So you need to be really careful. Would you like me to go through some examples?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So I'll give you a couple of really interesting ones. I've got a very good friend of mine owns a retail business in the food space. Now, for time immemorium, the price that businesses like his trade for, at the most optimistic, they trade for 6x earnings before interest and tax.
Yep.
Normally, when it's not optimistic, they trade for 3x earnings before interest and tax.
Yep.
He's just received an offer at 20x earnings before interest and tax. And at lunch last week, he asked me what I should do or what he should do. And I said, you should take 20x. That's pretty incredible. So that's one example. Now, that's just an anecdote in Australia, but let me tell you what's going on elsewhere in the world. Over in China now, the price earnings ratio for riskier small cap stocks are absolutely going bananas. Investors are piling in to the Chinese stock market to such an extent that volume on the Chinese stock exchanges is greater than Wall Street. I'll give you some examples. In March, 5 million new trading accounts were opened in China. Last week, 3.3 million new trading accounts were opened, 10x more than normal. The amount borrowed by investors to purchase shares has quadrupled since this time last year. And there's margin trading's going through the roof. Here's some other interesting facts. That's China.
Mm.
You might think, oh, that's unique to China, but what about the rest of the world? There's some companies in the United States that have recently listed. 80% of IPOs on the NASDAQ of IPOs on the NASDAQ in the last 12 months make no money. They're unprofitable, 80%, and they're listing. And I'll give you some interesting facts. There's a company called Noodles & Co., and you can go online and just type in Noodles & Co. United States and have a look at what they do. Let me tell you how earth-shattering Noodles & Co. is. It's a takeaway fast food restaurant.
Yes.
And they sell, get this, macaroni and cheese, noodles with butter,
all the healthy
pad thai, stroganoff on egg noodles. Nothing earth-shattering there about it.
No.
There's another company, park that one, there's another company called Potbelly Corp. And Potbelly is a sandwich bar, wait for it, sandwich bar. Nothing special really about that. Combined, they earn a little less than $2 million. They're not big enterprises, but Noodles & Co. is trading at 43 times estimated 2015 earnings, 43 times. And Potbelly is selling, remember it sells sandwiches, it's selling at 51 times earnings.
Slightly inflated.
Do you think?
You know, I think so.
Yeah, I think so too. You don't need to be... You don't need to be a rocket scientist to work out that these things are silly. Then there was a company called Shake Shack, and that's a more curious one. It started out in 2004 with a little cart in one of the parks on Manhattan Island. It's on a PE ratio that has, wait for it, four digits. So it's over 1,000 times earnings, and after it IPO'd, it's rallied more than 250%. So things are a little bit silly, just a little bit silly.
I mean, are those sort of overestimates likely to lead to a major correction at some point?
Well, corrections generally follow unbridled enthusiasm, periods of unbridled optimism, and I think we're seeing more and more pockets of that. At the collectors, you know, the car collecting shows all around the world, cars are selling for record prices. There was an auction of fine art, Macquarie Bank's collection of fine art last week, and there was one particular painting, and this is the most exaggerated example, but there was an estimate of $180,000 for the artwork, sold for $512,000.
Ooh, that has a shot.
And what I remember, Tony, in all the cycles that I've seen, and I've seen a lot of them in the last 25 years, when you see bubbles in art and you see bubbles in car prices, and you've got a lot of manufacturers now bringing out cars for $2 million a piece, limited edition cars for $2 million, when you see that kind of thing, I can just feel it in my bones. I can't tell you how it's going to end, Tony, but I know it's not going to end well. And so I'm not interested in taking on more risk. I think the risk taking is going to unwind. And the first sign of that is this jump over the last 4 days in bond interest rates.
Interesting. Couple of SMSs. One says, we've got a $175,000 mortgage. Would you recommend fixing interest rates at this point?
Well, you know what? I only ever borrowed once, and that was when I bought my first house, and I didn't know what interest rates were going to do, but I fixed then because there were so many different things going on in my life, Tony, so many variables. The last thing I needed varying was interest rates and an unpredictable interest rate. So I always fixed because I just wanted that to be something that was stable.
Rock solid. Yeah,
and interest rates now are at historic lows. If interest rates on fixed rate mortgages are being passed on and you can borrow now fixed for 5 years or even, I think, 10 years in some cases, then it makes a lot of sense to fix. I don't think rates are going much lower, but over the next 10 years, they'll probably go somewhat higher.
Another suggestion, ask a guest why we should invest in property when share gains in Australia gained 9.2%, but residential property gains were in the realm of 6%.
Well, I think, again, that's another example of somebody using averages over a long period of time to invest in specific assets. So this is an example of taking the index and the median house price and saying, therefore, if I buy this property or I buy those shares, that's the return I'm going to get. And that's not the case. You need to be very careful that you're not buying after a period of unbridled optimism because your rate will be lower. You'll get a lower rate. And then there's the theory of, you know, there's the order in which those returns occur. If you buy today and the market drops 20%, then it's going to take a long time before your average is 9% again, because you've got to recover that 20% before it even starts.
Roger, obviously there is a very large pool of investment dollars out there. You know, you only have to look at the amount of money that's going through superannuation at the moment to know that there's a lot of money being invested. And, you know, for people who, you know, require some sort of income, you know, self-funded retirees or, you know, people who are trying to be,
do you know what
it's a harder question.
Tony, it would sound, you know, the ideal answer for me, you know, I'd love to be able to sit here and give you a solution and say, here's what retirees who are desperate for income need to do. There's no answer to it. You know, it's a choice between a low return or higher risk. That at the bottom line, that is your choice. You either accept a low rate of return on something that is safe, like cash, and you make ends meet and you do what you can, or you take on more risk. And my concern is people are taking on more risk, and people, and when, you know, do you know what, Tony? Well, I reckon one of the key ingredients or seeds that you need that tells me we're in a bubble is when everyone thinks they're going to be rich. When you get the mass of the population believing that they're going to do very well from investing, and I think we're seeing that in the property market today, when that happens, when everyone does something en masse, my fear is that the stock market has historically been a really good transfer mechanism, transferring wealth from people who've got no patience to people who've got patience. And you have to be able to afford to be patient. And that means sometimes accepting 3% in cash for a short period of time, but 3% is better than minus 20% in the stock market. And that is a real risk. That is a real risk when you pay high prices for shares. Yeah. And right now, and I've just given you some examples there, you're paying high prices for shares.
Watch out for Noodles and Co. But also a lot of people suspect that, you know, house prices never go down, but, you know...
Well, that ain't true. The GFC showed us that.
That's right.
You know, the GFC, I can remember in Mosman, entire streets were for sale just on the quiet. They weren't advertising. And I saw property price, I saw declines of 40% from previous purchases. I saw individual houses that had sold for $10 million and they couldn't sell them for $6 million. You know, that's at the upper end, obviously.
Sure.
But I can remember people in my industry unable to sell their properties at 40% lower prices. So it's not true that property prices don't go down.
And in fact, a couple of friends of mine purchased a property that was essentially a shop and you know, industrial area, but in, you know, the main street suburbs, and they just could not sell.
No,
and there was just no buyers.
I know a rural town in northeast Victoria where my grandparents raised me when I was living in the country, and I can tell you that prices there in the last 2 years have dropped 50%. Over in Port Hedland, price falls for individual homes has been as much as 90%. So prices can go down. Now, you could argue Sydney and Melbourne are a bit different because both of those two examples that I just gave, really there was one source of income for the town, and when that stops, prices drop because people leave. So Sydney and Melbourne have more diversified incomes. But it isn't true just because of that that prices are immune from falls. And when prices have been bid up very, very high in a short space of time, there's equal chance that they could go down. And don't forget this, Tony. The government has done a great deal to help property prices. And I think, by the way, they'll continue to do that. You know, if I was John Howard and I had said, instead of saying we're going to give every first home buyer a $14,000 grant, I said what we're going to do, Tony, is we're going to give every Australian a $14,000 first share portfolio buyer's grant. What do you think would happen to stock prices? Mm. Would they go up or would they go down? They would go up. Would that be artificial or would it be real? Well, to a certain degree, there'd be an artificial element to it because the fundamentals of the underlying businesses haven't changed. All that's changed is the money in people's pockets to go and spend and bid up those prices. So that's what's been happening in property. And it'll keep happening, by the way, because here's an interesting idea. Baby boomers, the biggest cohort, you know, that are retiring now, most of their wealth is tied up in property. It's not in superannuation. It's actually in property in aggregate. And so it's not in the government's interest fiscally in terms of their budget management. It's not in their interest for that cohort of people to lose money when it comes time to sell their property to pay for their healthcare needs or their lifestyles.
Mm.
And so it's really important that property prices remain buoyant. So I'm not surprised that Joe Hockey recently put on the table the idea that people could access their superannuation to afford to buy a house. That doesn't, by the way, make housing more affordable. It actually makes housing more expensive because it pushes the prices up, which is great for baby boomers who need to sell. So I think we'll see a lot more of that. Yeah. And I'm not surprised he came out today and he said now's the time to borrow to buy either.
Mm. What are you expecting out of next week's budget? Anything?
Look, I think we're going to see changes to superannuation. That's already been flagged, and you know that the budgets are always, you know, the secrecy is not very secret. And so I think we're going to see some dramatic changes. But investors need to understand that budgets exist every year. So don't go and develop an investment strategy based on what's happening next in the budget. Every year there's a budget, and you know, unless the opposition agrees, then you'll find that a lot of the measures don't get approved anyway. And we saw last year's budget, you know, more than half of the suggestions, half of the policy decisions weren't implemented.
Mm.
I don't think it really matters. You know, when people say, Roger, you're going to stay up late to watch the budget, I sort of yawn. I think, no. And it's a bit of a waste of time. I'll wake up in the morning and I'll find out what the impact's going to be. But I'm not going to base an investment decision on it. What's more important is investing sensibly. And you mentioned in the introduction we wanted to talk about investing in Chinese stocks that are listed in Australia.
Yep.
I know I'm changing the subject a bit, but you know, this is a really important one. If there's one piece of advice that I want everyone listening to benefit from, it is do not buy shares of Chinese businesses listed in Australia or in the United States. And there's a very, very good reason for that. The reason is simple. In Australia, when a company lists and at the half year and the full year, they announce their results, those results are required to be audited. And that means that the auditing company has to go through the results. They have to agree with the terms of the results. They have to agree with the assumptions that the directors have made.
Yes.
And it's not very exciting, but essentially they sign off and they say, this is a true and fair and accurate picture of the company's position at this time. Otherwise, they put a qualification in and they say, we weren't able to get this information and that information, so it's a qualified statement from the auditors. Now, here's the interesting thing. When a Chinese company lists in Australia, the ultimate owner is usually the People's Republic of China, the PRC,
the government,
the Chinese government. Now, the Chinese government doesn't let our auditors get access to the financial information that the auditors need to qualify or unqualify the financial statements because the Chinese government deems that information to be a state secret. And so you can't get true information. Now, in the United States, what actually happened, which is really interesting, is the SEC sought access to the auditing records of Chinese companies. This is only this year,
yeah.
Suspected of fraud, because tens of billions of dollars in the United States have been lost in 171 examples of assets being transferred out of listed companies to private owners, and no one ever was chased down and no one ever got the money from that person. It was completely lost. Now, what was really interesting is the Securities and Exchange Commission in the United States. They asked Beijing for access to the information, and Beijing said no. And so, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission had the right to delist all these companies, and they chose not to. So there's a political reason for keeping these companies listed, but individual investors have no reason to invest in them. And so I really feel strongly about this, Tony, that you know there's not enough information. There's not enough information to be able to make a reasonable assessment. Now, I mentioned this yesterday at the Australian Shareholders Association, and I had a bunch of people come up to me afterwards and say they had lost money in companies where the assets had been transferred or there'd been fraud or some other example. There were 171 examples in the United States. There's been a couple in Australia where they've lost money. So you don't need to do it. Just steer clear. Very simple.
Interesting. Marion says, my home on the Gold Coast was purchased for $42,000 in 1978. By 1981, the market value was $91,000. Then, not long afterwards, it dropped down to the mid-40s.
There you go.
Those who borrowed on that equity went bust. All I know, some who did.
Yes. And it does happen, and it will happen again.
Roger Montgomery with us tonight from the Montgomery Fund, and we're talking about your finances. Good evening, Don. You wonder how exposed might banks be, particularly on derivative speculation.
Yes, exactly. And do we need Glass-Steagall?
great question. Look, I think the Basel III requirements that are going to be implemented are going to go a long way to shoring up the banks. You know, really what we're doing is we're taxing them for being too big to fail. We need to have, you know, as you rightly point out, we need to have a secure banking system. The last thing that we want in Australia is a run on the banks. And we avoided that during the GFC when Bankwest was hurriedly bought by the Commonwealth Bank. We avoided a run on the banks so everyone feels secure and comfortable. We also guaranteed deposits. And so I think we're going some way, and the financial system inquiry, David Murray's financial system inquiry, which I think will be implemented by APRA in pretty short order, certainly shorter order than what the banks expect. I think we're going to be in a situation where we can be fairly comfortable that we're not going to lose our money when it's on deposit in the banks. Having said that, though, that doesn't mean you won't lose your money buying bank shares. They could still drop, substantially.
Okay.
All right. Don sounds a bit nervous. Jackie, you're saying you've got some money in cash and you're wondering whether there are any good options at the moment.
That's right. Yeah, I've got $113,000 in cash.
Mm. And you look, I believe there are some. I can't give you personal investment advice and tell you what to go and buy. There are a few companies out there that we think are good quality and are still cheap, but they're few and far between. There's companies that you can go and research. I won't tell you to go and buy them because, look, quite frankly, we own these shares. And if you go and buy them, you're just helping me more than yourself. You know, it could be that they go and drop tomorrow. The fact that there's only a few companies that are cheap when the majority are expensive tells you that you need to be very cautious anyway. But companies in the telecommunications space are interesting. Companies in the healthcare space are interesting. And companies in financial services, such as fund managers, they're interesting as well. I think that's where you might find a little bit of value still. But all of this is dependent on the stock market not collapsing if interest rates at the long end of the yield curve start going up, which is what appears to be happening right now.
Okay, no worries.
Buyer beware, as they say. Nick, considering reducing your mortgage payment, you're saying that the sale will basically take care of the balance.
Yeah, look, I'm in a difficult situation here because I've got hungry developers trying to buy my house and land as I live in a new rail corridor in Sydney.
Yep,
and
good, lucky just, you, well done.
That's right, they're tripping over themselves.
Are you on the North Shore?
No, out Western Sydney.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, and like they have big parcels of land out here and they're killing themselves to buy our land.
Well, I'll tell you what you should do or you should think about doing. Here's an idea. Get together with all of your neighbours.
Oh, look, it's not a problem. I can tell you there's 25,000 metres between three of us that they're after.
Right, okay, so you've already spoken to the neighbours.
Mate, that's right. And in fact, neighbours, my mother-in-law, so that's good.
Yeah, these prices, I've got a very good friend who's a developer and also know another good friend of mine who's one of the biggest shopping centre owners in Australia, and they are both dumbfounded with the prices that exist or are available, particularly from offshore buyers at the moment. So in one example, and this was late last year, this particular friend of mine who runs a development company, he bought a building for $37 million and was planning on developing it and refurbing it and renting it out and putting it in a trust for his investors. 6 weeks later, he was offered $58 million. Yep. That doesn't come around very often.
No.
And if you hold out for the last dollar, you might miss out on all of the dollars.
That's very true. I'm very aware of that. Now, look, my situation is I'm being offered 10 times what the place is worth that I've invested in over the last 10 years.
Yep.
Should I reduce my mortgage down to the minimum payment? I'm paying 3.5 times what I ought to be paying just to knock it over. And now this
is for the same property that you've been offered, you've been bid on?
That's right.
Well, you won't have a mortgage once you've
absolutely
sold.
Absolutely not. So why should I be paying the bank my money? So I'm just wondering, that's the smartest thing, just give the bank the minimum. And then I should, have quite substantial leftover cash to do what I want.
Yeah, correct. Well, it sounds like if you're being offered 10 times what you think it's worth, I mean, go and get some advice. I can't give you advice. But
of course not.
But you've done the right thing talking to your neighbours, because the developers want large sites so that they can put thousands of units on it.
Yes.
Unless you're prepared to do that yourself, you might not see that price again.
Look, I have no idea how they arrive at their bottom line and what it's actually worth at the end of the day. I mean, they talk about floor space ratio, but that's way out of my league.
they're developers. They know what they're doing. And you've got the only thing to remember is that sometimes you've got an educated buyer and a less educated seller.
Yeah.
So what you really want to do to maximise the price is you want to create an auction environment for that property.
Mm.
So you really want to get some price tension there. If you are interested in selling,
trust me.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you've answered the question yourself.
Yeah. So win.
Mm.
Well done, Nick.
Well done.
Rebecca, you're running a property in a regional city, and you live in a major city, and you may be considering selling up the regional property?
Yes. We had 2 units on a block of land in Wollongong, and have moved to Sydney, and are renting in Sydney and now renting out both units. Yep. And basically the rent we pay and the amount is a...
What you receive for the properties down in Wollongong pays for the rent in Sydney?
Not quite.
Not quite. Okay.
And it's a very old house in Sydney.
But do you and your partner also have an income?
Yes.
Okay.
So, and we don't have guaranteed work at the moment, so that's why we're holding on to that. But
could you move back to Wollongong if things went badly in Sydney?
Yes.
Okay. So at the moment you're in a stable position. I can't tell you what the prices of houses are going to do in Sydney or in Wollongong, because I'm not in the business of forecasting these things.
My general question was, are regional areas more likely to drop faster?
Depends on the region. It really depends on the region. If Wollongong is, Wollongong's going through a gentrification, and it's taken a long time to replace the steel industry there. And to a certain degree, the coal industry, and it takes a long time for cities to recover. But Wollongong's going through that at the moment. I can't tell you what's going to happen in all regional areas. You have to look at the economics of each region. I'm just a little bit concerned overall that prices have been bid up to unsustainable levels because money's been cheap. As long as money stays cheap and people keep their jobs, there's no reason to expect a collapse in property prices. But if people either start losing their jobs and the unemployment rate in Australia starts going up, and or interest rates start rising again, well, you might find people are under pressure to sell their properties that they overgeared to buy. Keep in mind these couple of statistics. 60% of all credit is mortgages now. 60% of all credit is mortgages. It's the highest it's ever been. It's never been higher. And 43% of all mortgages, so 43% of that 60%, are interest-only loans. So there's a lot of people out there. And I heard one statistic recently from an author of a book who's done some research into this property market. They noted that using average income, so median income and median house prices in Sydney, if you've borrowed 80%, so you've got an LVR of 80%, then you're on your median income, then you are using 65 to 70% of that income in the first year to service your mortgage. Now, that's at present historic low interest rates. If interest rates did go up, and I'm not predicting that they will anytime soon, they've just been cut, but if interest rates did go up, then that could be a problem for people. And remember this, the government, the Reserve Bank of Australia, doesn't need to raise rates for banks to raise their rates. If banks' cost of funding goes up, they could raise rates independent of the Reserve Bank of Australia. Just keep that in mind too.
Yeah, good luck with that. Fergus, you were wondering how you can ensure companies actually pay employee super.
Yes, thank you for that. This is possibly just on the edge of what Mr. Montgomery might be able to advise. However, I'm approaching my 64th birthday in November, and I've worked as an independent contractor training in the industrial training area for the last, say, 9 years.
Yep.
And I've just I've discovered that the companies that use you as a contractor are flouting the law, namely that if you work for so many days per week, so many hours, and you can produce a track record, you're actually due to be allocated superannuation as part of your payment.
I think that's correct, and it's also true though that you're not a contractor under that scenario.
Correct.
You're an employee.
Absolutely.
And if it was with the same company and it was a certain percentage, I'm not sure. You're right. You know, it is on the edge of my knowledge,
yes.
But it's a certain amount of hours a week and so forth for the same employer, then you're deemed to be an employee, and you're right. But I would go and get some legal advice on that.
And the Australian Tax Office is the overarching body on that employee super.
Yeah, the problem is, Tony and Roger, is that when you call the Australian Taxation Office, it's in one of those two hard basket areas. They don't want to help. They don't want to know.
Right.
And they're the same people that wish to encourage us. And I took up superannuation in 83, 84, and I was about to be married. And I'm due this money in my, as I'm, going into that transition period?
Yeah, transition to retirement, correct.
And I'm owed something like...
And it's also the ATO that, you know, prosecutes you when you do the wrong thing. So
exactly right. They don't want to know when you ring them up about this.
Look, it is worth you getting some decent legal or financial advice on that.
Okay.
And you know, the first meeting generally is free with a lawyer or a financial planner. So you might get some answers from your first meeting. Then you can decide whether or not you want to prosecute your case.
Yeah, good luck with that. That's annoying beyond belief. David, you've got shares with a company that continually changes its name.
That's right, yeah.
I don't know what that means.
In about year 2000, I joined them.
Yes.
I think that they were a technology company. The telephone and digital and between 131 between digital and the alphabet.
Yes.
For dialing.
Yes.
That even been to sell the product to me in my business.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, because I got crook and I had to sell my business, so I'd been in for 25 years, and I thought, well, I'm a bit of a mess, so I might as well see what the share market's like.
Yes.
Being a bit on the outside.
Mm.
And I bought shares in it in about 2000.
Yep.
And a couple of friends knew a bit more about it financially the other way around, and they'd done the same. So I'd heard of it from both sides of the fence.
So it was self-reinforcing, you know.
Yeah. And especially for just going in for... And I only got $5,000 worth of shares, so it was only peanuts.
Yeah.
But the thing is, for someone with not much money, that was...
Sure. Pretty, yeah, it's important.
I was trying to be fair, dinkum.
Yep.
They changed that. They only in the first couple of years there was some diddling went on with the directors.
Oh dear.
And it changed its name from 131 to Focus or whatever.
Right.
And then it was still a technology company.
Yes.
One of the directors they bought in, the guy that gave him a great stack of shares and everything else to become a director.
Diluted you, yep.
He was from an Adelaide company that had gone, that had diddled a lot of people. But because the shares went from 20 or 30 cents down to about 12 cents or something.
Oh dear.
I thought, well, if I sell them, I've got bloody nothing anyway, so I might as well ride the storm out. And that then changed its name to Apollo Gold.
Yeah, right.
Become a gold mining company all of a sudden.
Okay.
This is not good news.
There's a lot of backdoor listings going on in this company.
Then it went on to another gold company name.
Yes.
I've forgotten now. Because
Have you had a chance to have a word with ASIC about it?
But it was told, it went from 131 to Focus when it was a technology company, and then went to Focus Minerals.
I understand the story. I've got a really good picture of what you're saying now. It sounds to me, you didn't do enough research to begin with, and then you've let a sort of a bad situation get worse. and you know, riding out the storm's not an investment strategy. We have a view in our company that when we find out that something didn't go the way we expected, we do what's called the Wall Street walk. We sell and then do some more research and try and analyse what's gone wrong. I don't know anything about the company that you're talking about, but it does sound like it's gone the wrong way, and it's, you know, unless you've got confidence.
Telecommunications to gold mining does sound like a leap.
Unless you think it's going to get better and you've got some really fundamental proof and evidence that it's going to get better, then, you know, I don't understand why you stay there.
Roger, thanks so much for being there tonight.
It's an absolute pleasure, Tony.
Roger Montgomery from the Montgomery Fund.